Hello, pals. Welcome to your new fortnightly episode. Barry said a couple of weeks ago he was still getting used to it. Me too. I'm sure if you're the kind of person who works relentlessly for good or ill, when you suddenly make the wise life decision to chill the fuck out, your body's mechanics can take a little while to get used to it. But I've thoroughly enjoyed the time off. What a thing to say at the start of a podcast. Hello, we're giving you less content, and let me tell you, I'm really enjoying it. But it's renewed my excitement for all sorts of work that I am making, including this, and including the book that me and Barry have been working on. But mostly what I'm going to talk about this week is give salutations to friends old and new. Hello to John Robinson, who is already a Patreon donor, but there was a little bit of a kerfuffle with the donation to Patreon, and so he rejoined us again for a following year, so it deserves at the very least a hat tip. And you'll be hearing from John later in the year when he is a guest judge on our episode about the world's worst pop star. It took us a while to find a guest for that. We think we've nailed a very well respected and notable British music journalist for that one. Also, welcome to new supporter Peter Schaub. Hello, Peter. Now, Peter has very cunningly gone for the same sort of donation tactic as John, which is that he is an annual supporter. And what that means, if you support us annually, you get a 10% discount. So Peter is donating a tenner a month, but actually he's donating a little bit less than that, but because he's given us a big old lump sum, he still gets all of the benefits. So Peter is getting stickers sent out to him, he's getting extra Patreon content, he is getting to, you're going to have to wait, because that is my delivery driver at the door. Now, more professional podcast hosts would have edited the delivery of their Deliveroo out. Podcast hosts more committed to the verite of their podcast would have left in the 90-second gap of me opening the door, getting my takeaway, dropping it off with my wife, having a quick chat with her about the fact that my daughter has still not gone to sleep, even though it's 3 minutes past nine in the evening, and then come back to you. But me, I left the first bit in, cut the second bit, because I respect you. Now, I was telling you about Peter. Because he's donating a tenner a month, he gets stickers, extra content, he gets to choose a topic and be a judge on the show. And Peter's topic that he's chosen is the world's worst apocalypse, which we're very much looking forward to doing. And also hello to Joe Kernan. Joe has given us a fiver a month in the traditional way, and he gave us a tasting menu of potential show topics to do. And me and Barry are tossing up whether to go for the straight down the road, world's worst country and western song, which feels like low-hanging fruit, because whilst there's one or two that are quite good, generally, as a genre, it's the armpit of the musical universe, I would suggest. Or the one that, as I speak to you now, I think I'm leaning towards world's worst national myth, which I think we can have a lot of fun with. I'm calling it now. We're going to do that. If you would like to join Joe, John, Peter and quite a few more people in donating to us and becoming a supporter, you can go to patreon.com/worstfootforward and do the business there. And one extra fun little thing you'll get because of the way we've reworked stuff is you will be getting some Patreon only content from our guest and from each show. So this week's guest is Joe Coles, who is an expert on all things aeronautical, and we've got an extra 7 to 10 minutes of us chatting away to him about really interesting and quite funny stuff from his world, but there wasn't really apposite to this podcast. So if you want to get that, chuck us a minimum of £2 a month and you can be part of that gang. For now, it's time to start the propellers, rev the engine, make sure that your seat is in the upright position, wink coquettishly at all of the air stewards and stewardesses, and get ready for a ride aboard the world's worst aircraft.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxtay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. This is your captain speaking. Welcome on board this podcast, WFF252. We are cruising at a height of 5'9", with our destination being your ears. Please now ensure that your seatbelt is securely fastened, that your armrest is up, your window blind is down, your left foot in and your right foot out, and only when instructed, shake it all about. Remember, if oxygen masks are required, we don't have any. Life jackets are stored under your seat. Made you look. And if you need to make an emergency exit via the inflatable slides, please make sure you do say we all the way down. And alongside me is the Co to my pilot, the Leslie to my Nielsen, and the May to my day, Ben Vanderveld.
Hello there, frequent flyers. Just so you know, exits have all been sealed and they will not be opened up until we have dispensed everything on my trolley.
Now, the emergency exit seats are a coveted location on an aircraft for many people. How do you feel about being loaded with them?
It's basically the equation of responsibility versus legroom, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I always get turned off by the fact they go, now, in the case of emergency, you may be asked to help. It's like I've been suddenly conscripted. Yeah.
I do feel like... surely they should be scanning people for the most dependable human on the flight. Because, ironically, in the event of an air crash, I would begin flapping immensely. The only possibility of me being located next to the exits being a good idea is if things started to go code red, I could just tag in my wife and she would take care of things.
Well, the problem is you've got kids now. They probably wouldn't let you have the emergency exit seats.
Oh, no, that's a good point. Because, yeah, if you open an emergency exit wrong, then a 3-year-old will just ping out of the airlock, won't they?
To be fair, your son, as in his early toddler years, really enjoyed opening and closing doors. And that would be a nightmare for the cabin crew.
God, it really would. But I spent quite a lot of time next to the emergency exit on a recent flight with my kids. Just because, understandably, my 20-month-year-old daughter just wanted to parade up and down the gangway. And thankfully, those doors look quite complex to open and close. There's a lot of wheels and locks and hooks and safety catches.
Yeah, it's an escape room. With a really, well, really, really like life or death timing situation.
Yes, an escape room where very much you don't want to escape from it.
Yeah.
Before we encourage you to do any more irresponsible behaviour on board your latest flight, we should introduce this week's guest, who is a curator of the remarkable and encyclopedic aviation blog Hush Kit, lauded by aviation historians, scientists and pilots all around the globe. He's an enthusiastic authority on anything with wings, that is, not from Mother Nature, and almost shares a name with the scorer of my favourite and most ultimately pointless England World Cup goal. It is a delight to welcome the marvellous man in his flying machine blog, Joe Coles. Hello, Joe.
Hello there. It's lovely to be here.
Are you the victim of a lot of that stuff we get on social media and online these days where people think they're writing to Tony Hawk, but they're writing to Tony Hawks or that guy who's John Lewis every Christmas?
Google myself, I find things that are owned by Joe Cole. So like the SPN, bless you. So like if I Google myself, I might see Joe Cole's car or Joe Cole's wife. So very much in the shadow. I don't know anything about football, I'm afraid, but I guess I heard he was a good footballer. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, eminently breakable footballer, unfortunately. So maybe you had as much a chance of maintaining a run in the England starting 11 as he did.
I might have a go.
Yeah, I'd say actually he was similarly softly spoken as you as well.
Yeah, that's very true.
That's what I've enjoyed from all of our phone calls. You do sort of have a pilot voice.
A reassuring voice. Okay, well, that's kind to say. I think I've got a kind of patronising Cliff Richard voice, I think. But
wow. Well, congratulations on that, if I may say so. We've discovered that you're very good at lulling Ben into a sense of security, whether it's true or false. What are you worst at in the world?
What am I worst at in the world? I'm really, really bad at knitting. Tried knitting once and I found it the most stressful thing I've ever done. Like, my brain can't do knitting at all. So, yeah.
How, now, when you say you tried knitting, did you, like, pick up a friend's needles and yarn and start having a go, or did you, like, actually try and follow a pattern?
Myself
or?
And a friend were taught at this, introduced to it at the same time, and he talked about how easy it was, and I just got sort of a fast heart rate, felt like I was really stupid and just had all my fingers tied together and thought it's knitting is terrible, a terrible, terrible thing.
Knitting is a remarkable art, a craft, I get, as being the place where the Women's Institute meets fractal geometry. Which is... And also, I like the fact that you say you're terrible at knitting, because obviously there's some fairly sharp weaponry involved. I'd like the thought that you attempted a little knit one, purl one scarf and ended up with three victims and blood everywhere.
It wasn't as bad as that. It wasn't as bad as casualties, but I just found it incredibly difficult and disheartening, and really regret doing it, and I'm never going back to knitting.
It's had a real resurgence with the, like, you know, the likes of Tom Daly, for example, doing a lot of his crochet and so on, and so I think it's become very popular, like, pastime for people, to just something to be doing, a trick on the tube, or, you know, sitting at home watching TV is a really easy thing to be doing. But I always look, when people are knitting like scarves and things, I look at the ball of yarn that they're working with, and then the size of the scarf that has emerged, and it does feel like they're, like, making gold out of base metal. It just seems like, how has this enormous thing come out of this tiny thing? The ratios don't seem to add up for me.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. I think they're amazing, people who can knit.
Can I ask, because I completely empathize with your anxiety about getting knitting wrong or failing to understand it, as someone who's got a great passion for flying, have you flown a plane?
Have I flown a plane? I've had a very, very limited time flying a plane. In that time, I've almost collided with two aircraft. Maybe I should put that as my worst skill, actually.
It's not so good for the personal brand, though, I think, if you say I'm the worst at planes.
Just the thought of, you know, I can completely understand the thought of there being too much going on with knitting, but on the odd occasion that I've sat in the cabin of a plane, I'm like, there's a lot of data coming towards me from dials and flashing buttons and joysticks, and I'm like, if you're overwhelmed by a ball of yarn, Joe, you should stay away from the flight deck. I spent an awful lot of time looking back at the very, very ancient history of aircraft. Obviously, as we know, although I am waiting for Joe to let off an enormous QI klaxon as I say this, the Wright brothers did the first manned powered flight in 1903.
Probably, yeah, probably.
Good.
I'll depends accept the that.
Well, I think we did World's Worst Pilot recently. I think we added several qualifiers to the front of that statement.
It depends what country you come from. Different people claim their country had the first aeroplane, but I think it probably is the Wright brothers.
All right, we'll let them have that. And we chatted a lot about Montgolfier and his hot air balloon in the late 18th century. But in terms of ancient civilizations, famously, there are ancient Greeks who may have come up with designs for the combustion engine, but there was a strategist called Archytas who lived from 428 to 347 BC, and he is reputed to have designed and built the first artificial self-propelled flying device. Unsurprisingly, it was bird-shaped, and it was propelled by a jet of what was probably steam and was said to have flown about 200 meters. And according to the ancient Greek mathematician and statesman Aulus Gellius, the machine was called Peristera, which is Greek for pigeon, and it was suspended on a wire or a pivot for its flight. And according to him, it was powered by a concealed aura.
Sorry, he was suspended on a wire. He invented a mobile, Ben. It's a mobile.
I'm aware that these... Listen, everything I'm going to talk about for the next 5 to 7 minutes can be put under the heading of tenuous as fuck.
Yeah, and also, the build-up of steam to get it to go 200 metres, that's projected, didn't fly, it was projected 200 metres.
It's a jet-propelled cable car, isn't it? It's not...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely sounds Sounds cool, though.
They invented the ski lift.
Yeah. Next, we're going to go into the world of myth, and I love this myth. This is a myth from Persia about a mythological Iranian king called, or Persian king, I guess, called Kay Carvus. And he, in the epic poem Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, which was written around the end of the 10th century, it was said that he had a flying throne. And this throne, you're going to love how it was propelled. Attached to each corner of the throne were four long poles pointing upwards. And these on the throne were made of wood and gold. And attached to the end of each pole, there were specially trained eagles. And then at the other end of the pole, pieces of meat were attached. And so the ravenous eagles had their feet chained to one end of the pole and were eagerly trying to chase and catch the meat. And the power of that caused the throne to fly.
Oh. That's a very like posh version of the carrot on a stick for a donkey, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't get posher than an eagle. Wow. That reminds me, there's a story of a Chinese poet scientist, and he decided to tie like 200 fireworks to his chair, and this is a few hundred years ago, and the fireworks went off, exploded. But as he disappeared, the people thought he'd succeeded and thought he'd flown up into space.
Oh, well, that allies...
They can't prove he didn't. Can't prove he didn't.
Well, the next two things I was going to talk about, one was going to be in the Far East, but I'm going to briefly head to the Ottoman Empire in the 17th century and tell you about a chap called Lagari Hasan Celebi, who was an inventor at the time. And rather than an aeroplane, he was interested in rockets. And he had a seven-winged rocket, and using 140 pounds of gunpowder, he attempted to fly over Istanbul. And the flight was said to be undertaken at the time of the birth of Sultan Murad IV's daughter, and it's a celebration of that. And what I love about it is what Celebi said. So apparently, before the launch, he turned to the Sultan and said, "Oh, my Sultan, be blessed. I am going to talk to Jesus." And apparently, he ascended in the rocket, landed in the sea, swam ashore, and his first line back was, "Oh, my Sultan, Jesus sends his regards to you." Got like he's got real sort of Hannibal and the A-Team vibes about him, doesn't he?
Jesus sends his regards.
Right.
It's so good. Also, seven wings, did you say?
Yes.
Because by and large, aircraft, there are a couple of notable modern exceptions, but by and large, aircraft do aim for symmetry.
Yeah, well, I mean, to know, maybe it was three on each side and then one fin.
One fin, yeah, that's okay, that makes a bit more sense.
I have on the Hushkit site on the top 10 asymmetrical aircraft. So there are some freaky asymmetrical ones then on that.
I would find that really disconcerting to get in somehow. It feels less aerodynamic, even though obviously...
So is there science that backs up being able to have asymmetrical aircraft? Because like Barry says, it seems to the layman nonsensical.
I think there's loads of times when it does make sense, and there's been perfectly decent aircraft that were massively asymmetrical. But I think as we're used to animals that are kind of symmetrical down the central axis and things that are weird to us, which don't do that. So I think it's just psychological. Yeah. There's no reason why you can't build aircraft that are like that.
You mentioned the Far East, China, Japan, and that is the part of the world that I believe that kites and kite technology were most advanced in both the ancient and early world. And so in China, kites were used to carry men. Now, sometimes they were used as a punishment. So according to the Book of Sui, dating from 636 CE, there was a tyrant called Gao Yang. He executed his prisoners by ordering them to fly using bamboo mats. And basically, I think he sort of tied them to these kites, flew them up in the air, cut the cords, and they fell to their death. But also they were used for reconnaissance, and no greater authority than Marco Polo described that Chinese sailors would strap a man to a kite, stick him up in the air, and use him to work out where to go next.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think people would be fairly surprised at how early military aerial reconnaissance has been going on for. The French had a hot air balloon they used in 1794 during the Battle of Fleurus in the French Revolution. They did aerial observations for about 9 hours with a tethered hot air balloon, so they just sent it up so they could get a better view. And the aeronaut wrote down the movement of the Austrian troops and so on, and then dropped the notes to the floor from the air, from the balloon. He would just sort of drop them overboard. And during the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln established the Balloon Corps. It had 7 hot air balloons in it, and even a flat top balloon barge, like what was adapted from a steamboat, apparently. And they had names like Intrepid and so on, and they could spy on enemy movements from up to 15 miles or something like that.
And reconnaissance air balloons, of course, is still around today, and they were responsible for a lot of the UFO sightings in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I suppose because there's probably less tech on it for radar to pick up on.
It's more that they can just hang around for a long time and, you know, fly very high. Yeah, very largely it's the altitude thing. They're very, very visible on radar because they're very big.
Oh, I see. All right. And the thing that the Balloon Corps found during the American Civil War is that they were very good targets to be shot at, so they were disbanded in 1863.
I mean, my main relationship with, if I see a large balloon in the sky, what I tend to think is, oh, the test match is on. Lovely. One last thing before my choice. In 2015, at Mumbai University, the 102nd Indian Science Congress was held, and there was a lecture delivered by Anand J. Bodas, who was a pilot, and a chap called Ameya Jadhav, who held a master's degree in Sanskrit. And they claimed that in Vedic times, so it's about 7,000 years ago, the Indian people had the technology to fly. And they based this on various different texts, and particularly talking about something called vimanas. Now, a vimana is a Sanskrit word, and literally it means either measuring out or traversing, but can also refer to a chariot of the gods. The reason why they backed up the claim so much is because the text that they were talking about had actual designs that looked a bit like an aeroplane. Now there are.
But aeroplanes look a bit like a bird, so that's absolute bobbins.
It is. These look more like aeroplanes than other claims, because there are some people who've claimed that they've seen helicopters and aeroplanes in Egyptian hieroglyphics and on ancient Colombian artifacts. This had a little bit more heft behind it. He claimed that the ancient planes had 40 small engines, a flexible exhaust system, and could maneuver in any direction.
What kind of engines were they?
And there we go. The witness cracks under pressure.
I mean, it's possible. I mean, there are, you know, like the case with the ancient Greek computer, there are technologies that get lost, but there's out of kind of a sense of sort of national pride, every nation claims it invented the flying machine, and they people go to great jumps in logic and sort of stretching credulity to claim that their country invented flying machines, because it's such a point of pride. And I think the main thing that illustrates is how we are proud of them as an invention. They are incredible things, as we were talking about earlier. They are miracles. And yeah, every country invented it, if you talk to certain people. Yeah.
And the problem is now, because there's, you know, countries keep playing one-upmanship with one another about it, we're now back to people claiming that several thousand years ago they invented flying machines, as opposed to, oh, was it the Wright brothers, or was it someone French a year before them, or was it someone Italian a year before that? And they've just been going backwards and backwards. So now, eventually, we're going to go, the dinosaurs invented them.
Exactly. Aztec spaceships, flying pyramids, and whatever.
Yeah.
Well, so I can't explain how the engines worked, because obviously they did not. But as far as I can see, the text, which is called the Vaimanika Sastra, and the text was revealed as late as 1952, and it was asserted that it was written by a chap called Pandit Subharia Shastri, who lived from the mid-19th century well into the 20th century, and he claimed that he was channeling it from a more transcendental plane, which is a very useful get out of jail.
Oh, it's total cobblers then, is it?
I did hear the word transcendental plane in there though, so that does lend certain credence.
Yeah, that's how the engines worked, transcendentally. Yeah.
the thing I'm seeing, I'm just googling this now, and I'm seeing like a thing that's kind of like a wedding cake. Is that the thing?
Yep, that's absolutely it. That's the design. And one person who has critiqued it has said that the technical illustration based on the texts are, according to a chap called J.B. Hare, absurdly un-aerodynamic. He says they look like a brutalist wedding cake with minarets, a huge ornithopter wings, and dinky propellers. In other words, they look like typically early 20th century fantasy flying machines with an Indian twist.
Yeah, I mean, it's a jelly mold, isn't it? But it's... it wouldn't be able to use lift to fly. Like you say, the aerodynamics is very strange. There's real aircraft that are slightly like it. There was a French aircraft called the Coleopter, which was a big barrel with a sort of the propulsion system down the middle. So you occasionally do get things that look a little bit like this, but they're all about thrust rather than lift. So you can have things kind of this shape, but this thing does look like a load of nonsense, I guess.
Oh, God, yeah. My favourite critique of it, to end on this, is a chap from the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore commissioned a study on it. And at the end, the study noted, this is just a beautifully Indian turn of phrase, if the craft is taken to mean what the drawing on the text say, it can be stated that the craft is a decided impossibility. And I enjoy that very much. But for my nomination for worst aircraft, we are going well into the 20th century, and we're going to go to Delacna HZ-1. And this was developed by the United States Army for reconnaissance purposes, and it was believed to have two major advantages. It was believed that it could provide the sort of mobility on an atomic battlefield, because it was designed sort of in the early years of the Cold War, and give it that sort of nimbleness that traditional cavalry had in previous centuries. It was also believed that because of the nature of it, of which I'm about to explain in a moment, untrained soldiers and pilots could hop on it with about 20 minutes training. Now, how do I describe the Delacna HZ-1? I'm going to say it looks like a pogo stick with a helicopter propeller underneath your feet.
Yeah, that's basically it.
It is an insane piece of design. There are actually two propellers underneath, and as part of the design to cut down on weight...
Sorry, they're rotors rather than propellers, I believe.
Yes.
Oh, what's the difference between a rotor and a propeller?
A rotor can be used for vertical lift, which is what we're doing with this. Yeah.
Ah, cool. Got you.
Every day is a school day.
Every day is a school day. Yeah, the difference here is me and Barry can see that this would not work. Joe can tell us why it would not work.
Yeah. It does look very much like someone stuck a lectern on top of a helicopter and then removed the bottom bit of the helicopter.
I don't fully understand why the guy on the lectern wouldn't just spin round and round and round and round and round and then be thrown into the next field. But there were only, from what I can see, a couple of test flights that led to injuries. Oh. No?
Only a couple that led to injuries. Actually, yeah, it seemed like they did 160 flights in 1955.
Oh, 15
hours of flight time. And they were like, oh, actually, it seems to work. And then when they did some properly in-depth free-flying tests rather than just, you know, does it go up and down with an actual pilot, then they had a couple of accidents, as you said. Which seemed to involve the rotors intertwining with one another a lot of the time, which they couldn't really understand why it was happening.
The most alarming thing is you have this... If the pilot slips, he's going to be turned into mincemeat. to do like an uncaged, huge, contra-rotating, you know, rotary blade that you stand next to. And it's kind of interesting because it's steered by leaning. And you were talking earlier about how a balloon is a good target. But a man floating a few meters above a battlefield, making a really loud noise, is also a really good target.
Yeah, it's very true.
He does sort of look like something from a very satisfying computer game where you get to knock him off his rotating platform and, as you say, gets consumed by his rotors like the giant mustachioed Nazi that Indiana Jones fights in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And then, annoyingly, the eagles lifting it up would see the meat and dive to the ground. To make sure the body was repatriated. I can't remember the name of the guy who did a lot of the later test flights, but he was given a medal for determining that it didn't work. He was like, oh, I could have gotten that medal. You could have shown it to me and I'd go, I bet that doesn't work. And yeah, I cannot imagine being the soldier who signs up to fly that.
Yeah, that takes some balls, doesn't it, to do that?
Yeah, someone
with... hopefully not very big, low-hanging balls. Yeah.
it's steered by leaning, isn't it?
Yeah, and some of the test flights lasted up to 43 minutes, which is pretty decent flight time for such a
minimal. It's like 75 miles an hour
vehicle,
so it's a decent speed. Yeah. It's just, yeah, the guy is going to be very vulnerable up there, isn't he, in loads of ways.
Because I always think helicopters must be, I've not flown in a helicopter, but I always think they must be quite an intimidating thing to fly inside generally in a normal helicopter, and now you've removed the safety capsule.
I've flown in a helicopter and it was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. We went, it was
really?
On mine and my wife's honeymoon, we flew over Victoria Falls in Zambia,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, absolutely stunning, incredible to look at from the ground. And we had the offer of doing a helicopter, and we're like, yeah, sure, why not? But I have a more overactive imagination than my wife. And I was looking out the window and about 40% of me was going, wow, the majesty of nature, how incredible to view it from above. And the other 60% was going, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. Which is not really what you want to experience on day three of wedded life.
I've bought something really... really horrible, really horrible. It's really horrible, horrible, dark story I've got for you, if you're interested.
Excellent.
So we're in World War One, and we're in America. We're in North Carolina, and there's a guy called Dr. William Christmas. And it's hard to work out whether he's a con man or deluded or both, but he was mad, like just an enormous bullshitter, and he gets away with it consistently. So he appears on the scene in 1918. World War One's about to end, and airplanes are now a really big deal and a good way to make money. And he goes around telling people he made an airplane in 1907, yet no one ever saw his airplane. No one had heard of his company. But he's still, you know, he's adamant about doing this. So he then starts to raise money build an aeroplane to kidnap the Kaiser from Germany to end the war. And everyone's like, well, this sounds like a good idea.
Crowdfunding. Sorry. The only thing that's stopping us kidnapping the Emperor of Germany is we don't have the right aeroplane.
He's also claiming that Germany asked him to take over their warplane building business and offered him $1 million. Again, no one has any... He's the only one saying that. So he convinces this brokerage firm to invest in this aeroplane, and they get in a senator, Senator Wadsworth. So now Christmas... He's got a bit of clout, but he needs an engine. So... thanks to the senator, largely, he manages to convince the US Army Air Service to lend them a prototype of a really advanced engine. And they say, okay, you can borrow that on condition that you don't fly it on anything until we see what you've made Just it's just for ground tests. We'd obviously want to see your plane. This is the only one we've got of the super advanced, brilliant aeroplane. So he then goes about building a really weird aeroplane that to any engineer is a deeply alarming idea. So at the time, you need braces and struts to hold your wings up to stop them flapping. So yeah. He decides not to put any struts on them to build.
I'm sorry. I do not want to get in an aeroplane whose design is are shared with Oliver Hardy's trousers.
It's built of steel and hardwood, and it's called the Bullet. And he tries to get a test pilot for this, and all the test pilots he get look at it and they say, "No chance. I'm not flying this thing. You're insane. Like the wings are just going to fall off. There's nothing supporting the wings." And eventually he finds this guy, Cuthbert Mills, who's kind of out of luck, ex-war pilot, who's run out of money. And Dr. Christmas is a great charmer, and he charms Cuthbert and says, "You're going to be a big hero. You're going to fly this plane." So Cuthbert's so proud, he invites his mum to watch the test flight.
Oh.
And he takes off successfully. Then the
Can I ask at this point whether this is with the special prototype engine inside it?
It's the special prototype engine that is promised not to fly.
But presumably the government are not there checking up on this flight.
The government are not there. He's just doing what he likes. Yeah. So it takes off, successfully flies a few hundred metres. Then the wings, of course, twist, fall off. And poor Cuthbert dies in front of his mum.
Oh, no.
Dr. Christmas doesn't give a shit. He's unapologetic about the engine is destroyed, but the life is destroyed. And so what he does at this point is builds a second bullet and takes it to the New York Air Show and advertises it as the safest, easiest controlled plane in the world, despite the fact the only one that's flown crashed and killed a guy.
Jesus.
He then flies this one and it, of course, crashes and kills the guy.
Oh, no. Come on.
Then being the guy he is, he then stands up in Congress and says he's built the fastest, safest, most efficient airplane on Earth and that all the Europeans want to buy it.
In a way, the early years of aviation was a wild west. For all we know, these planes were the fastest and safest planes compared to everything else at the time.
The thing is, they had loads of great aeronautical engineers. They, you know, if they wanted to do research, they could find out this guy was talking rubbish, but he was a great con man, like really charming. And in 1923, he bills the US Army $100,000 for inventing an amazing wing design. And this is the same wing that has done nothing good. And then he becomes this the biggest like property developer in Florida and dies very, very rich at 94 years old in 1960. So my entry for this would be, the Christmas Bullet. I think it's scandalous.
Christmas Bullet? Who was issuing, like, the $100,000 order for the... Was it Matt Hancock in charge of all the appropriation at the time? Because, jeez Louise. I kind of love the 1920s where people are just like, well, a man's word is his bond. He shook my hand on it, so by golly, we just must trust him.
It's I mean, a couple of things I love about it. All of the names involved are just tremendous. Dr. William Whitney Christmas is definitely fictional, as is, to give him his full title, the down on his luck pilot Cuthbert Mills. Like, he's definitely went to pilot school with Biggles.
Yeah.
Looking at a picture of the aeroplane, what it reminds me of, you know those magazines you can get in the newsagent that are like, buy our first issue for just $2.99 and in 437 issues you too can build a full aircraft carrier. But it's like the absolute budget version of that, because the aeroplane looks like it's been assembled by an overambitious 6-year-old.
I mean, that era is still... people are still pushing all the buttons on how to make the best aeroplane and seeing what works. So I guess, I mean, they will have had, like you said, engineers and experts and so on, but it's given that, you know, flight is still only about 20 years old, powered manned flight and all of that is only about 20 years old. Is it that daft that they were like, maybe this guy is onto something?
Well, I think like if they'd asked any expert, and the fact that no pilots wanted to fly it apart from this guy who had a big debt shows you that they had enough awareness. And I also think he's a psychopath, like his lack of remorse and the fact he just keeps plowing on. And after killing two guys, goes to Congress to tell them he's made the safest plane in the world. And it's got a 100% fatal crash record. I think he's like an amazing piece of shit, this guy. I'm kind of fascinated by him.
Yeah. Did he, that were they the two planes he stopped? Like he sold the wing design and then went into property. He sort of left his airplane.
Once he got his money, he left his airplanes. But if you look at his stuff on Wikipedia, I think because all his planes were made up, if you click on any other airplanes he made other than the Christmas Bullet, it's like there's nothing on the Wikipedia page. Imagination.
What did you say his full name was, Ben? Dr. William Whitney Disambiguation Christmas, I think I heard. I read about guppies, the pregnant guppy and later the super guppy. These are a modified Boeing 377, the pregnant guppy, which you know what a little guppy fish looks like. It's just from side on, it has the same profile as one of those, this thing. It was the only one pregnant guppy was ever made. It flew for 15 years from 1962 to 1977. Very large, wide-bodied, and very tall cargo plane. And the reason it was built was for NASA. They needed to transport components of the Apollo moon program. A lot of these pieces that made up the spacecraft were really big, and so they needed a specially made aircraft to transport them around. And so, yeah, it was built by Aerospace Lines and could carry a maximum weight of 141,000 pounds. And later on, Aerospace Lines made the Super Guppy, which, a similar thing, carry 170,000 pounds worth of cargo. Wingspan of more than 150 feet, nearly 144 feet long, and it was, the only plane large enough to assist in carrying some of the parts of the components of Apollo, specifically the third section of the Saturn V rocket. From the front, the Super Guppy looks like the typical alien face, you know, the sort of pointed chin and bulbous sort of balloon shaped head, and where the windows are, they do look a little bit like alien eyes. It's slightly disconcerting.
Oh yeah, it's got a real sort of what's the name of that whale with the enormous forehead? I think it's a beluga whale.
Yes, beluga. Yes, correct. In fact, I think the Airbus have beluga airplanes, don't they?
That's the replacement for their Super Guppies. It's called the beluga. I'm curious you've gone for worse because I think it's quite good. Are you going on looks?
I just sort of wanted to mention it for its look. I think it looks sort of weird. Yeah, I think it's very effective. Evidently, that they use these.
You've nailed it. It does look like one of the aliens.
Yeah. Or a little bit, it reminds me a little bit of Kirby the Ghost from some of the Super Mario games.
Yes. Yeah, either way, I just imagine it'd be quite disconcerting, again, to be in an aircraft which has such enormous headroom.
I mean, I find it very disconcerting to be walking around with such enormous headroom myself.
It kind of looked like Vic Reeves, Lloyd Grossman.
Oh my God, imagine the in-flight meals aboard that.
Yeah, oh my God. I want to mention the flying pancake as well, which I think you have on Hushkit, Joe. It's used by the US Navy during World War II, wingspan of more than 32 feet. Officially, it was called the Vought XF-5U airplane, and it looks odd because it looks like a stingray. Basically, it's kind of round nearly in its design. Only one pilot could hold a couple of 1,000-pound bombs, and had machine guns mounted on it and so on. The thing I really liked about it, I mean, it could fly very fast, 550 miles an hour, and it was, like I say, armed to the teeth. But the thing that caught my eye in reading about it is that they were so sturdy and well made that they needed a wrecking ball to destroy them when they were decommissioning them. The main problem was that there was too much vibration when it was in flight, which is why they didn't sort of catch on. But you can see a prototype of it in the Smithsonian, if you want to go and see one.
Had, when it was destroyed, it had a gearbox that had $6,000 worth of silver in it. So that's about what, wow, $75,000 worth of dollar silver. So the staff and the security personnel scour the scrapyard, but they fail to find the missing silver. And eventually, a local scrap dealer who hauled the wreckage was caught by the FBI trying to sell the silver. But as Vought, the company made it, had made the mistake, it was found that the dealer's actions were completely legal, and the dealer kept the silver. And Vought, the company, was forced to pay back the Navy for not telling the wreckers.
That's so good. Oh my God. that scrap dealer is absolute, like, jackpot day at work.
He got, $80,000 out of that.
Wow. That's amazing. I read a little bit more about hot air balloons and dirigibles, the first Britain's first military aircraft, British Army Dirigible Number 1, or as it was known, Nulli Secundus, which is the Latin for second to none, which first flew on the 10th of September 1907. It was built at the Army's balloon factory in Farnborough, and it was designed by Colonel James Templer, Colonel John Capper, and Samuel Cody. And it had quite large cylindrical envelope constructed from gold beater skin, which is like ox skin, I think. And it was suspended by four silk bands. And the control surfaces had a rudder and elevators at the rear, and a pair of large elevators amidships, and another pair at the front. And then underneath it, with the crew, was a small gondola. Which literally looks like a canoe underneath a large dirigible. Which, again, it's like one of the, it's like the Delachner aerocycle. I don't know about volunteering to be in a boat attached to an aircraft. Its big public debut was on the 5th of October 1907, and it flew from Farnborough, which is about 40 kilometers southwest of London, and it flew over the city. It took in Whitehall. It flew over Buckingham Palace. It circled St. Paul's Cathedral. And you must say, what a sight that must have been for the people of London in 1907. And then they attempted to turn around and go back to Farnborough. But 18-mile-an-hour headwinds meant they just got to land in Crystal Palace in the south of London instead. So about 40k short of their destination. But they flew for 3 hours, 25 minutes. Covered 50 miles or so. And it was still moored at Crystal Palace a few days later because the winds had stayed really high. And it was buffeted so severely that the guy ropes tore free and some of the hydrogen began to escape through the valves. So eventually they thought, well, fuck it. They cut it open, let all the hydrogen out, deflated it, dismantled it, and took it back to Farnborough on land instead. A few other hot air balloons I liked. August 2002, at Johnson Space Center in Houston, you could have seen the head of the Statue of Liberty flying, because you get a lot of these hot air balloons which are in the shape of other things.
Oh, nice.
The Swiss Alps in January 2003, you could have seen a flying cow at the ski resort in Château d'Œx.
Do you know what they need to do with these huge hot air balloons of different shapes? If they gather them all together, it will look like God's mobile phone set to the emojis page.
Yeah, it's very, particularly this one, a 246 foot and three high and 338 foot long balloon cathedral designed by Jan Kaiser and Martin Zimmermann was used to celebrate the 200 year jubilee of the Swiss canton of St. Gallen in 2003. And man, that's really big. That's the size of an actual cathedral. The 90-foot-high head of Vincent van Gogh flew in the Netherlands in 2003. A space shuttle-shaped balloon flew in Nebraska in the 2000s, which was about 50% larger than the actual space shuttle. And I like this one. June 2014, in Melbourne, Australia, as part of Australia's bid for the World Cup campaign, a statue of Christ the Redeemer wearing the colours of Australia's national football team was flown.
That's a nice one.
I mean, to be fair, the colours of the Australian national football team aren't that far away from the Brazilian national colours.
Yeah, I know, but they were campaigning for Australia to get the World Cup. And then roping Jesus into it. Like, I guess it was, maybe they wanted the hand of God involved in the bid somehow, but
No, Jesus is a goalkeeper.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. Maybe from the ground it looked like Christ the Redeemer. Actually, it was a goalkeeper with long hair before a penalty.
No, yeah, well, precisely. Well, of course he's a goalkeeper because Jesus saves.
And I like this story. This is one that we didn't touch on last time we talked about hot air balloons. In 1808, two Frenchmen found themselves in a love triangle with a lady called Mademoiselle Tirevite, who was an opera dancer. And they had a duel, but they didn't have a duel on the streets of Paris. They took to the skies above Paris. They had and people on the ground thought there was going to be a balloon race. But no, the two men, in their two hot air balloons, then drew their blunderbusses and aimed them at each other's balloons. And fired upon each other. And one of the balloons was punctured and crashed onto the buildings below, killing, it says its occupants here, which presumably means that one of the guys had brought, they'd brought their seconds up with them. and the other guy landed safely and presumably won the hand of Mademoiselle Tirevite.
Have you bumped into Madame Portevant? I pronounced it wrong, I'm sure. But she was, in 1852, she wanted to recreate the Greek goddess Europa. So what she did is she tied a huge bull to an air balloon and took off from Chelsea Pleasure Gardens riding a live bull. A live bull.
And we talked about a guy who used to fly up on platforms on top of a horse. So you'd have a horse on this platform with a hot air balloon above him, who's French as well. So it seems a particularly French habit, this.
She was Greek, but she crashed in Essex. And they, the people in Essex didn't like it. People from Ilford didn't like it, and they killed the bull. She freaked them out by landing in a field on a live bull. And the Essex people didn't like that.
But they took it out on the bull.
Yeah.
Don't know why I find that so funny. It's also the fact that she wanted to imitate a Greek goddess and she floated all the way from Chelsea to Essex. Right, made in Chelsea and the only way is Essex. There's a combo of British reality TV shows in there somewhere.
There it is. I mean, that's better than trying to do an impersonation of Odin aboard Sleipnir and having to glue four extra legs onto a stallion.
Yeah, to be fair. And one more inflatable aircraft. This is the Goodyear Inflatoplane, or the GA-33. And now this is Goodyear, who make tyres and, you know, they have their blimps. And so they, you know, they have a bit of a track record in aircraft. They came up with the idea of a portable aircraft that could be dropped to downed pilots who might be trapped behind enemy lines. The entire airplane, in theory, would be able to be carried on the back of a jeep or a truck or inside the hold of another aircraft. And the way they would do it is it would be inflatable. They built 12 prototypes in the 1950s. Testing continued until the 1970s when they cancelled it. And the whole aircraft could be contained inside a 1.25 cubic meter container, which is a decent sized Amazon delivery box. And yeah, they could carry it on other vehicles and drop it down. The way it worked, from what I understand, is that when the nylon it was made of was exposed to the air, it absorbed and repelled water, and so it helped it stiffen. And it gave it its shape and rigidity. And then the structural integrity was retained in flight with the forced air of the aircraft's motor being circulated around it. And so that continuous pressure supply enabled it to keep up a degree of resilience to punctures and so on. And they tested it and showed that it could be punctured by up to 6 30 caliber bullets and still retain its pressure, which is pretty good going.
That is pretty good going. I'm not sure I'd enjoy being part of that test.
Yeah. It took about 5 minutes to inflate, and at full size, it was about nearly 6 meters long, had a wingspan of just over 6 meters.
If I was shot down behind enemy lines and I had 5 minutes to inflate my plane and I knew that the troops were closing in and I was just furiously going... I would feel so anxious that I may as well have brought with my own inflatable brass band that was playing Morse code to say, I am here, please come shoot me.
You're doing balloon animals, but making an airplane out of them. A snake, a dog, and now my escape vehicle. The pilot then had to hand start the two-stroke cycle 40 horsepower engine, and they could take off with a maximum load of about 240 pounds. So I guess a pilot in full gear with a bit of equipment, that's kind of as much as it could handle. And I don't know where the fuel, I presume the fuel is probably inside the container as well. 20 gallons of fuel, it could fly 390 miles, which is, again, pretty good. Endure for 6.5 mm-hmm. hours, and its maximum speed was 72 miles an hour. The Army, after after about 15 years of testing, decided that a blow-up aircraft wasn't the practical extraction vehicle they were hoping for. So it didn't really see much action. But it's an it's an intriguing idea.
They've tried some very alarming extraction techniques. They've repeatedly come back to the idea of pods on the wings of helicopters and Harriers as well. So that a Harrier jump jet lands next to you if you've fallen in enemy territory, and you get put in a little fiberglass tube next to a very, very loud engine, and then you're flown home across a battlefield at 600 miles an hour. I can't remember if it's got a window at the front or not. You're lying in this little tube, but that somehow never caught on.
Yeah. I can't really imagine. Yeah, because the noise of those things is outrageous. And you're saying they're just like sticking this little ball beside it on the wing.
Yeah. Yeah, you're in a little, wow. a little plastic tube on the wing.
Outrageous. But that's not my choice for the world's worst aircraft. I've gone with the Caproni CA-60 Transaereo, often referred to as the Noviplano, or nine wing. It's what it sounds like. It has nine wings, three sets of triple wings, so like a triplane, but it's got three sets of them. It was meant to be a 100-passenger transatlantic liner, and this is in the early 1920s, at the time when this was still thought to be like a ridiculous idea. That airplanes could only carry a couple of people, basically. And only one example of it was ever built. It was designed by an Italian aviation pioneer called Gianni Caproni. It was built by his company, and it was tested not in a transatlantic flight, but on Lake Maggiore in 1921. And its brief maiden flight took place in February or March, and then its second flight was on March the 4th. And as with most of these stories, shortly after takeoff, the aircraft crashed on the water surface and broke up upon impact, and it was later damaged even more when the wreck was towed to shore, and he wanted to rebuild it, but it was abandoned because it was too expensive eventually. And there's a few parts of it on display in the Gianni Caproni Museum in Italy. Caproni had a decent track record as a aircraft designer. He made some airplanes for the Italians during the war. And in 1913, he told the Italian newspaper La Gazzetta dello Sport that aircraft with a capacity of 100 people and more passengers would soon become a reality. So he was visionary in that sense. He could see the way things were going, and he knew that technology would eventually exist. He tried to convert some of the larger wartime bombers that he'd made into airliners, but that wasn't really doing it for him. He thought he needed to start again from scratch and build this passenger craft. And he took a patent out in 1919. And he decided it was going to be a passenger flying boat. So as I say, the test flight took place on Lake Maggiore. And part of the thinking behind this was that he sort of betrays his lack of confidence in the idea in some ways, that it could crash on water with less damage being done to it.
That's not exactly playing to the top of the room, is it, when it comes to design?
Yeah, he's already going, this might not work. Now, the thing I like about, and I do encourage you to go look it up, we've all seen the pictures of a biplane with the two twin props. This has got triple wings three times over along the length of it, and it's got a massive cabin at the bottom of it because he wants to get 100 people inside it.
It looks like someone's, those tourist boats that go along the Thames or along the canals in Amsterdam?
Yeah.
It looks like someone has stuck the set of a Wild West stuntman punch-up on top of them. It looks looks like three open saloons on top of a canal boat.
And the thing I liked about this story, and obviously it didn't work, it looks ridiculous, but I have other reasons for wanting to pick it as my worst aircraft. On the day of its big test flight, the 4th of March 1921, Caproni was coming to Lake Maggiore by car, and his car was delayed, so much so that he only arrived after the plane had crashed.
Great.
Not only that, there are no photos of the takeoff, the flight, or the crash, because the photographer was on the car with Caproni. So the photographer was also delayed. The only photos the photographer got were of the aftermath and the wreckage of the plane on the lake.
There's another part of the story as well, isn't there, which was the aircraft was destroyed in a mysterious fire. He was trying to rebuild it, but there was a mysterious fire which burnt it, which I don't think was actually mysterious.
Yeah, there are some people trying to discourage him from rebuilding it or putting it on display. So there's only a couple of bits of it in his museum. At the time, the accident was blamed on a couple of things. One story was that the pilot was inexperienced and it was human error. Another story is that it was blamed on a steamboat navigating the lake close to the takeoff area. And the wake of the steamboat disrupted the water in such a way that it interfered with takeoff. If your aircraft cannot cope with some choppy water when it's meant to be a flying boat, then maybe it's not as effective as you think it is. Another theory suggests that actually the boat was loaded with passengers. It was a ferry. And that the pilot, Semprini his name was, suddenly had to take off because he was had to avoid a collision. So he thought he was only going to be performing some taxiing trials and he didn't mean to take off before Caproni arrived, but he was going to crash with a boat and had to try and take off to avoid it. The story I really like, and the more recent theories, suggest that the accident occurred because of sandbags. Obviously, they needed to test that it would be able to hold as many passengers as it was intended to. And so they placed sandbags inside the aircraft on the seats to simulate passengers. What they didn't do was belt the sandbags in like passengers to their seats. And so when the plane took off, the aircraft lifted up and all the sandbags plummeted backwards through the cabin to the back of the plane.
Oh no.
Pitching it upwards. And so the tail then made contact with the water and basically flipped and crashed. And the image of if they had gone with testing it with 100 people and all of them flying backwards through the cabin was too much for me to resist. So that's why I've picked the Caproni CA60 Transaero, or the Novi Plano.
It's a lovely choice. There's a really nice photograph of just afterwards. There's a boatman helping with the wreckage, and the boatman is laughing at it.
Yeah. Yes. So our candidates this week for the world's worst aircraft are Ben's suggestion of the De Lackner Aerocycle, the Segway to death. Joe's suggestion of the Christmas Bullet, the gift that keeps on killing. And my suggestion of the Caproni CA60 Novi Plano, the multi-story aircraft carrier undone by the waters of Lake Maggiore. Very good all round. I have to say, I really like the story of the Christmas Bullet, and I love the chutzpah of Bill Christmas. But I think it's him. The plane is obviously terrible, but I think he sort of adds to the terribleness of it in many ways. And I love Caproni's design. And I love the story of the testing day and the sandbags and the ferry and him not being there. There's so many details to it. But in terms of an actual aircraft, I just would not want to get on board. When I saw the picture of the De Lackner Aerocycle when I was Googling stuff yesterday, I genuinely gasped and uttered the words, oh no. And to be fair, it lasted more test flights than any of the other two we talked about. But as an idea of actually being on board one, as a nervous flyer for myself, I think it's the one I would least want to get on board.
Oh, it's the safest by far, though, isn't it? Terrifying. But the other ones are guaranteed to crash within seconds. So I can fly around for half an hour.
I know, but they look more like planes, Joe. I can't help the psychology of it.
Being next to a human mincer, though, that's like...
That's it. Do you want to take off in my food mixer? That is the thing. That's what I don't like about it. So I think I'm going to give it to Ben on this occasion, and I'll overlook the expert. I'm so sorry, Joe.
Madness. Absolutely.
Madness. I know. But I'm discounting the research in favour of my feelings, which is very 2022. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week, and this comes from a lady called Angela Cole. Angela Cole is a great-grandmother who is 89 years old, and she is set to become an internationally published author with a book that she started writing when she was 12 years old.
Oh,
77 years after she started writing this book. She's been working on this novel titled La Familia for pretty much all of her life, and the contents of the story have been around for as long as her grandchildren can remember, on little scraps of paper with tales just scribbled on them. And last year, her granddaughter Heidi Lindsay decided she wanted to organise Angela's work into a fully fleshed out book and have it published, and the family are now making that happen. And Familia tells the story of Angela's mother, Arietta, and her father, Noti, and the life that they built together in Egypt, where they met. And Angela said, if these stories weren't written down or narrated to others, they would have simply washed away like a grain of sand taken away by a wave. She's such an author already. She was mesmerized, apparently, by her parents, and she wrote the stories down, and she loves it when someone tells me a story and I write it down. Whether I like it or not, it doesn't matter. It's a story. Real people. And instead of becoming an author, which has been her lifelong dream, she actually worked as a police interpreter, and she's now finally getting her big break. Courtesy of her granddaughter, as I said, and they've secured a publisher after months of research and so on. And so, yeah, it's quite a cute story of someone late in life achieving their dream, which I really, really liked. So yeah, Angela Cole, look out for her book La Familia coming at some point in the next month or two, I think.
Oh, speaking of which, can I plug my book?
I was just about to say, from one Cole to another Coles, is there anything you would like to plug, Joe?
Oh, that's a great question. We've done the Hushkit Book of Warplanes, which we've collected the best articles, but made them even better, added like world-class illustrations, put this beautiful coffee table book, and there's new stuff that we've never published. And it's this huge, great, beautiful coffee table book. It's entirely crowdfunded. It's fully funded now, and it's coming out in October or November this year, but you can pre-order now with loads of great pledge levels. That's volume one in the unbound.com. And there's, more importantly, I would say, is volume two, which is even better, and that hasn't fully funded yet. And if anyone is interested in aircraft or in anything in life, they should order volume two of that from the Unbound site and visit our site, hushkit.net, which has got over a thousand now totally free articles. So that's my plug.
Yeah, absolutely.
Smashing. I love, Joe, that you went through the same emotional journey that we often do when we mention how many episodes we've done. Yeah. It's like, oh, over 1,000. Oh, well, that's what I've done with my life. Okay, good.
Tashka had its 10-year anniversary the other day, and someone said, here's to another 10 years. I was like, Christ, no, not.
Well, having perused it in researching this episode, I can highly recommend it. Do go and have a look. And thank you, Joe, for coming on the show. Oh, it's been our pleasure. Meanwhile, we're all off to see if Ben can invent the Hanukkah catapult. Thank you for listening to Westwood Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, God, it would have nine wings as well, wouldn't it?